Fabian Caudrey was born into cricketing royalty. On his Kent debut, before he'd faced even a single ball, he received a standing ovation from a packed house at Canterbury. Many of those fans were seated in a stand named after his grandfather Colin. 3 years later, at the age of 24, he announced his retirement from all forms of cricket. You're listening to the All Over Cricket Podcast. Visit us at allovercrick.com. Follow us at All Over Crick on Twitter and Facebook. Here's Fabian on his battles with mental health and why he walked away from cricket. Fabian, I'm so glad we're doing this. Welcome to the AOC podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to delving into my past in cricket and what that entails for me today.
You know, to be perfectly honest, I'm just a little bit nervous about our discussion. It's not necessarily because of who I'm speaking to, but it's because of what the two of us will be speaking about. I first came across your story in an article written by Sam Dowling. And Sam, I mean, if you're listening to this, thank you so much for supporting All Over Cricket and being one of our first subscribers. We haven't forgotten about you, and we'll link your article in the show notes. So it was that, and then a few, I would say 5 or 6 weeks ago, I came across your episode 2 of the Between the Ears podcast. And, you know, like I told you in our messages, it felt like you were telling my story in a way. So with this podcast, you know, obviously, I think everyone wants to hear your story. But if we're going to do something different, and, you know, I, for the first time in a public forum, I plan to open up about my struggles with mental health, addiction, and how cricket featured into that, especially in my childhood. So it's exciting, but I'm nervous because I'm vulnerable right now.
But yeah, it's difficult to be vulnerable. But I think for me, the realization is, when you're honest with people, not only do you come off as more authentic, but you're actually able to deal with things more openly, and it helps you progress in your own life. If you've got everything working emotionally and mentally, everything else tends to fall into place. So me holding onto my past and delving into my own traumas by myself without voicing them would be detrimental to my mental health. So if I can use some of my stories and some of my experiences to help other people, which I'm trying to do actively now. I'm now a qualified life coach. So I support people in transformation and transition, which is something that I'm very passionate about, and also the transferable skills from sport into other walks of life. So, but I do think that it's important that we all continue to speak about these things, and if only just to help other people as well as ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And we'll touch on more on what you're doing with Cow Corner and what you're doing as a life coach later in the podcast. Just to kick things off, just talk to us about what was it like growing up as a Caudrey, and, you know, your relationship with your dad in your first, you know, when you first started playing cricket.
Yeah, I mean, I was born into a very famous cricketing dynasty, as lots of people know, and it was fantastic growing up. I mean, I had a former England cricket captain to talk to about various different things about cricket. I used to watch lots of sports with him on the sofa. We had a real father-son bond. I mean, I remember playing games, and Dad tried to shelter me from the expectation of the Caudrey surname by hiding behind trees because he didn't really want me to understand the gravitas that came with the name. So I was very much a normal kid. I sort of overlooked people arriving at my games randomly to watch me, even at school, because it happened a lot. And I just thought nothing of it. I was just enjoying cricket. Cricket was very much my escape, and absolutely loved it. And from some interesting times growing up on the playground, where I was a bit different, I always threw myself into creative avenues as opposed to intellectual avenues like science and maths, which I was terrible at. Apart from sort of calculating my cricket average, I was pretty poor at maths. And I was at a very academic school, and you know, growing up, trying to use sport as that get out of jail card was very real to me. And yes, it had its pressures being born into the Cowdery family, but in my early years, they were only positive things, and I really enjoyed having my dad around.
Yeah, you just mentioned something about using cricket as your get out of jail card. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I think it was something where I used sport as an emotional freedom. Like when I crossed the white line to go and play cricket, I'd make sure that I batted the full 50 overs, or I was having a big part to play in the field, so I didn't have to come off the field, because there were two very different feelings for me. One off the park, where I didn't really necessarily feel accepted for who I was or what I was, and there was a lot of journey of self-discovery, as there is for everyone when you're young. And cricket was that get out of jail. It was, you feel completely at peace, you feel completely yourself. And I was a bit of a schoolboy cricketing prodigy, so I did pretty well on the cricket pitch. So it filled me with a lot of confidence, and I just absolutely loved it growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think there was something in your podcast where at some point in your cricketing journey, I feel like we're fast forwarding a few years here. I believe your parents split up. Mm-hmm. And after a while, you and your father, I guess, you start to grow apart little bit. So, you know, just talk us through going through, you know, I guess, for lack of a better word, good times as a child, and the change from that to, I guess, your teenage or your early 20s, and how all that played out.
Yeah, sure. Well, as a son normally has with his father, the father's the invincible hero and completely perfect in every way as you grow up. And then as you go through those teenage years when things are transitioning personally and also emotionally, as you progress, that you realize that everyone's a bit more human than you first gave them credit for. When I was 18, I signed my first professional contract. On the evening after that conversation with the CEO at Kent, I had a chat with my mum and my brother, who very, very rudely and abruptly walked into me when I was in the bath. So I had to cover the bath with loads of bubbles, because I was like, look, I'm an adolescent male. Can you please give me 5 minutes just to finish washing? And they were like, no, we've got to talk to you. So I was like, oh my God, okay. And they then revealed that, you know, mum and dad were separating. And that was almost like I'd been on the high, the euphoria of achieving this childhood dream, worked my whole life, you know, used cricket as that escape goat really from some darker times growing up. And suddenly I was a professional sportsman, which was crazy. And then on the same day, being told that my hero, or, you know, my father, who I'd always looked up to, was breaking up with my mother. And that caused some fairly difficult times for me in my early career, because I didn't really have anywhere to turn, really. When I visited Kent County Cricket Ground, if you've been there, you'll know that there's a stand named after my grandfather, the Colin Cowdery Stand. And then the Stuart Cheeseman Pavilion, which is where the players all change. That's my great grandfather from the other side of the family. So my grandma's side, who married Colin. So there was lots of family tradition there, and I was reminded of his legacy every time I went to the ground, albeit a very limited communication system that I had with him in my early years. And when I went home, there was quite a lot of trauma there as well, because it was a broken home. So it left me in a little bit of a crossroads, and albeit I'm happy for those experiences now, because they've taught me who I am, I wouldn't really wish that on anyone, to be honest.
I guess in a way, the Cowderys are—they're basically Kent royalty.
Well, absolutely. And it was funny when my dad told me about the autobiography that was written, called "Good Enough?" Which was his book. And that was because when he was compared to his father, Colin, every time he went to the Kent ground, before the start of play, he'd be having some hits in the nets just to prepare for his innings. And you'd get all the county fans come up to him and say, oh, I remember in 1957 when I watched your father get 300 not out for Kent. And he thought, oh my, I'm 300 runs short of that. I haven't even had a bat yet. So you can imagine the the pressures when everyone was reminding him of his father's legacy. So he went through exactly the same, if not even more intense, because his father was, you know, played 114 test matches and averaged 40 plus with 22 test hundreds. So that was slightly different for him. But by the same token, I think I was reminded of the importance of the surname on my debut against a touring New Zealand team when I walked out to bat with my name on my back and the pavilions and the stands and all of that. And it was a packed house at Canterbury, maybe 7,000 to 10,000, in intimate grounds, and they all applauded me to the wicket. And I hadn't even hit a ball in the first team. I got a standing ovation. And then in that moment, you begin to realize that there's something a lot more important than you going on. And that was the first time I thought, okay, this is a bit unique now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess if there was all that pressure on you, which it sounds like it certainly was, at least from the outside looking in, it wouldn't have been apparent to the casual observer. You started off with a quick fire half century on List A debut. There was a season of the Blast. I believe you were partnering Daniel Bell Drummond up at the top of the order, and I think you were averaging somewhere in the high 30s or early 40s with a really good strike rate that season as well. And so, you know, just tell us more about the early days and what was going on the field and in your personal life as well, in, you know, your first few seasons at Kent.
I was a kid. I was living my dream for that first year or two. I was dealing quite well with the news of my mum and dad. I tried to distract myself from it as much as I could. I was enjoying my cricket in the first season or two. Naive, playing with freedom. I was given opportunity in the white ball stuff, although I didn't necessarily deserve opportunity in the white ball stuff. In the second 11 at Kent, I was scoring hundreds in the three-day game, in the four-day game, but wasn't getting many runs in the white ball. And they picked me to play in 2020 and asked me to have a slog in the middle overs in my first game. And I did quite well trying to produce shots that I'd never played off before. But to be honest, I was sort of out of place. I felt like I should have been playing in the Red Bull game more so, which frustrated me in a large way, because when they did give me opportunities to play in Red Bull, it was for one or two games. And if I didn't perform, I was dropped. So I never really had what I felt was the backing that I needed just to give me a chance to learn about first-class cricket. So they turned me into more of a white ball cricketer, which was really tough for me. And I did well. I did well at the top of the order, and then found the following season they had me down at number six or seven bowling left arm spin. And I was a batsman who threw some left arm darts down. So they were consistently trying to change my game to get me in the team. But what they didn't realize perhaps at the time was that was having quite a damaging effect on me as a player, because I was a batsman. I'd scored runs all my life. I only started bowling because I got bored fielding. And that was the way that I was always played the game. I batted at the top, people would bat around me. And I think because I was always shifted around after those early two seasons, after some success, just so they could get me in the team, I didn't really have a role. I was just sort of a bits and pieces player. And I think that affected my confidence quite a lot in the later part of my career.
And I guess that sort of showed up in your performances as well towards the end of your time at Kent. And I think it was the eve of the 2017 season, you were aged 24. 24. And you decided to walk away from the game. Just like how did you come to that decision? Was it something you'd been thinking about for a year and a half in the lead up to it? How did that materialize?
Yeah, you're right. I was thinking about it for a while. I had an appendicitis in my last season, which knocked me out for a few months. And I remember that season thinking, you know, I would do anything to be away from the ground right now. I was almost asking the universe for an injury, and I got it. I got an appendicitis, which meant I couldn't really leave my bed. And I was, you know, I couldn't really get out of bed to play, which at the time was an absolute godsend for me, because I didn't want to be there. I'd worked so hard towards this that it was all very confusing in my mind as to why I had little interest in performing. I think looking back on it, I put unnecessary pressure on by the time I was 23 or 24, becoming something that my grandfather had become by that age or my dad had become by that age, and been more of a concrete number in the Kent 11. And I only realized that when I look back that I was putting that pressure on myself. But in hindsight, when I reflect, I felt like I still had the talent to play, and I still, if things had been slightly different, whether that be me being a little bit more sure of myself, more self-belief, played with more freedom, but also if I'd been given more opportunities and more of a chance to play where I was used to bat where I was used to be given a chance at the roles that I'd been doing through my youth that I succeeded in, instead of being shuffled around so much, that who knows, maybe there would have been an opportunity for me to still be playing right now. But it got to a stage where I lost who I was playing cricket, whereas cricket had always been my identity. I was sort of wondering what I was doing it for anymore. And that became really, really low place for me, because it was the only thing that made me happy growing up. And I didn't want to get out of bed to play. And when I had that injury, I was so pleased, which sounds ridiculous and quite spoiled in many ways for someone who's making quite good money playing their dream. But I didn't want to play anymore. And I knew that it was right to my teammates, but also myself, that I don't carry on in that manner. And you're right, the performances began to dip. I wasn't playing. I was, you know, it was a pretty horrific period for me personally, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to, you know, relate my story to that as well. So in no way is this, you know, on the same scale or, you know, does my story have even close to as much publicity, but it, as a, you know, youth level cricketer in Hong Kong, you know, I feel like I was pretty good at the sport as a child and as a young teenager. And for me, I guess my upbringing was my story's a little bit different. So I never really had a great relationship with my father. So for me, and there was basically just a lot of trauma and bereavement when I was growing up as a child in my home. And for me, cricket was a way to get away from that. This trauma and bereavement, it manifested in just this anger. And it was just a very emotionally repressed but grieving household that I grew up in. It's not something I felt at the time or realized at the time, but it's something I've come to realize in the last couple of years especially. So for me, cricket was my escape from that. And just socially as well, it took me a little longer to figure out the sort of social rules that come really easy to a lot of children and a lot of teenagers. So for me, it took me really long to learn all of that. And because of my learning disabilities as well, I wasn't exactly the strongest student starting off in school. So for me, cricket was my escape, and it was brilliant watching cricket, playing cricket. I had an autobiography assignment in the sixth grade, and we're supposed to write about ourselves. I wrote the whole thing was about cricket. the whole thing was about cricket. There were pages, my top 10 batsmen, my top 10 bowlers, and my teacher was not very happy with that. But in any case, the point is, cricket was my escape, and it was my way of getting away from all of that. But at one point, I picked up an injury playing football, of all things, and I broke my arm. And then I broke another arm. I broke my other arm the next year. And basically, cricket suddenly became this high-pressure thing where if I did not do well, then I'd have to spend more time at home. And it just, there was all this pressure all of a sudden. And I went from being part of, I think, the final 21 for the Hong Kong under 13 team, and being identified as quite a promising cricketer. And I feel like I had a decent shot of going on that tour as well. And that's when I kind of started to freeze up a little bit So I'd get to the crease, and this is where, you know, my ADHD started to act up, and I just wouldn't see the ball. I'd be thinking about a million different things. It really hurt my confidence as a bowler as well. For some reason I switched to bowling the flattest, most useless off spin you will ever come across.
I think it's amazing how we connect certain sports or certain experiences or whatever it might be to sort of suppress something that's a lot deeper going on underneath the surface. And Ed Smith came up with a good line when I heard him speak about it, and it was the former England chairman of selectors, and he said, if you want to be successful, play cricket as if you were a kid without any of that extra pressures going through your head. And I know that they came in slightly early for you at age 12 or 13, which is unique to you, but having that freedom of mind and having that perspective and understanding, you know, it's and that freedom just to go out there without feeling like you're going to freeze because you're associating something to previous trauma or an escape from somewhere. And, you know, that's what happened in many ways. Looking back, is cricket was my escape growing up, and it wasn't my escape once mum and dad separated. It became something different to me. And I think from then on, as you get a little bit older, you begin to realize why certain things happened, and there's a lot of reflection. But I completely understand the synchronicity between our journeys, for sure.
You mentioned pressure just now, and I think I read this in either Sam's piece or I heard it at the podcast, but you wanted to captain England, right?
Yeah, I mean, from age 5 or 6, I remember my dad giving me my first bat, and I was putting linseed oil on it, and I was, you know, telling him to throw me balls in the garden, even when he was busy working in the office, and just annoying him, really. And from that moment on, that was all I wanted to do. I used to have dreams about walking out at Lord's, and, you know, that's all I ever wanted to do. So as you can imagine, when it got to 18, when I signed that contract, you can only imagine the feelings that were coursing through me. And then following later on that day, when my mum and dad separated, things began to, I'd never really experienced such a high and then such a low. And at 24, stopping playing was something that I never envisaged, walking away from the game that had brought me such joy. That was something which was completely off field and out of field. And I didn't really know how to deal with myself or what I was or what I represented following that decision. But all I knew is I couldn't be in that environment anymore, which was crazy. And I had to try and make sense of it. You know, I had to try and work out what on earth I was here for again, in that sort of identity crisis, on top of having, I suppose, the family name and people writing things like Fabian. You know, there's an article written about me. Fabian retires to support his twin brother writing lyrics on his music. I mean, that was not what I said to him. And they were sort of creating that as if I'd given up sport to become Julius's lyricist. You know, little things like that just grate you a little bit, but the decision was made for my mental health, and on reflection, I've learned so much about myself as a result of that experience, and I wouldn't have it any other way looking back at it now. Do I still feel I could do a job playing professional cricket? I look at the T20s sometimes and the one day stuff, and definitely feel that I could slot in quite nicely still. But it's behind me now, I think. So we're moving forward.
Do you still play recreationally?
Yeah, so I play on the weekends for my cricket club. I played a bit of league cricket. I'm now a mentor and a coach at Sutton Cricket Club in the Surrey Championship. They're in Division One, looking to get up to the Premier League, and I'm bat number 4 for them. And just enjoy it a little bit more. Although there's a different kind of pressure playing in league cricket after playing professional cricket, which is you should be getting 100 every game, or at least everyone thinks you should. So it's gone from, you know, trying to fight for your place to being the first member on the team sheet and should be leading by example every time. So it's just a different kind of pressure, but it's as you get a bit older, you become a little bit more familiar with all of those things and can deal with it a bit better.
Do people still come to watch you?
My dad hasn't been to watch me yet, which is interesting, but he'll get down. Not really. A few people. I've had a few autographs to sign even now, which is crazy. I've been out the game 4 years and you have people waiting on the side asking me to sign something. But it is what it is. And the name will always be there, and I still perform quite well at times in my cricket career, and I remember those times fondly.
For any young athletes and young cricketers coming up nowadays, what advice do you have for them to protect their mental health and you know, stay happy, I guess, while playing cricket?
But it's tricky because cricket is so statistical, whatever the word is. It's quite difficult to get it out. It's all about numbers. So, you know, when people are trying to find their feet, the performances speak for themselves. You can't hide anywhere. But what I would say is cricket is just a game. I think sometimes cricket's made out to be more than that. It becomes a life. It becomes everything. It becomes their happiness, their sadness. It represents every emotion. But if you simplify it to its simplest form, it is just the game of cricket. And for me, it was when I wasn't playing, I was practicing or thinking about it. It became completely immersive, and I couldn't really escape that. So also having an escape from that, do you like to go and play golf? Do you like to write lyrics or whatever it might be? You know, what makes you happy away from cricket? And try and identify that and give yourself time to breathe instead of becoming completely reliant on cricket to serve your happiness. So have a hobby and also take it in your stride. It's just sport.
I guess that doesn't just apply to sports people and cricketers, and it doesn't just apply to using cricket or sport as that thing that your happiness is fully dependent on. I guess with a lot of people, they use things such as even relationships, and their happiness and their contentment is tied to this external validation, or even work. You have people who are addicted to work, and we haven't even got into addiction to substances. But you know, just having that over reliance on the external world, and that being so important for you to, I guess, address or feel good inside. I think that's such a common theme across industries, and whether it's sport or cricket or anything else. So
yeah, this is so much deeper than cricket or your job. It's very much the moment you begin to feel that contentment and that genuine contentment without reaching for external validation is when you actually can look in the mirror and say, I actually quite like the reflection I'm seeing. I actually quite like the person that I am. And that comes from a self-love journey beginning, really. And actually accepting your imperfections. And sport was, for me, it was, if you fail, you get dropped. You know, there was no room for mediocrity. There was no room for, in my head, there was no room for human error. And the problem is that failure is a part of life. And my attitude to failure was maybe because I was dropped every time that I didn't perform, or I was almost taught in that environment that anything less than 100% out of me was not good enough. And that created a lot of damaging emotions. So coming out of sport, just to be easy on myself and accept that I'm not going to get everything right all the time. I might play and miss at a few balls, or, you know, metaphorically in life. And I might make some mistakes. But with that understanding that, you know, you've got to at some point accept that you're not perfect, and that you are going to, you know, make some pretty bad errors in your life just because you're human, gives you a lot more perspective on life. And actually, it's important that you have that integrated into your mindset. Otherwise, it's going to be a very, very long and difficult journey, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting to hear you talk about this. I'm actually just wondering, how did you come to this realization? How did you gain, for lack of a better word, how did you gain this wisdom? You know, going from the bloke in 2016 to 5 years later, like, what's happened between now and then?
Yeah, it's a tricky question. Experience, life. I had one option. I could either continue to suppress my emotions by thinking that everything was going to be perfect, or I had to face myself and my reality and be like, right, this version of me isn't working because I'm not thinking correctly. And I had to speak to a lot of people. I visited Mike Brearley, the former England captain, who's a psychologist, to talk to him about a few things. And I had to learn about myself. And by doing that, I had to face some of the emotions that I didn't want to face. And I had to go back to to write to the roots of why I was feeling a certain way. Got some support from the PCA for my mental health and just understand myself a bit better. It came from, you know, the pressures actually stem from not loving myself, from giving myself too much of a hard time. So I suppose the wisdom has come from my recovery, you know, having to almost resurrect my mindset to survive basically emotionally. So, you know, looking over the years, those cricketing experiences and that person that I was, is actually a bit of a blessing in disguise, because it's led me to a number of things that I'm doing now, where I can support people and have sort of what my mother might say is an old head on young shoulders. So it's exciting to sort of have refound myself. And that was a journey that I didn't necessarily think was possible, considering my adoration for sport and particularly cricket. So to be away from that and be in a better place than I ever was playing cricket is unimaginable, but it's the truth now, and happy for those setbacks.
I definitely relate to what you just said, you know, being happy for the setbacks. I feel like suffering is a really, really good teacher. Sometimes it feels like it just will never end. So basically right after being released from rehab, I was in rehab for 3 months. Right after being released from rehab, I went through a phase where I was bedbound for 8 months with post-acute withdrawal syndrome. And the symptoms were crazy. They in many ways, they mimicked chronic fatigue syndrome. So I could barely get out of bed. And if I went for a walk longer than 30 minutes, I'd completely crash. My brain didn't work. I had total brain fog. It was really hard for me to have conversations and process thoughts. And this whole time, I just assumed, oh my God, my life is over. I don't know when this is going to end. And I had every reason to believe that's it. You know, this is my life. And 25, you know, I made it to 25 and now I'm done. I have nothing else to contribute. So all of that and 5 to 6 years, probably 5 years of being in active addiction. Sometimes I look back on it, I'm like, how did that not completely destroy me? And if it wasn't for all of that, I would not be the person I am today. I would not have the wisdom that I have today. And in a strange way, it's almost as if I had to go through that, or it was inevitable. Like, it was just going to happen. And now it's happened, but it's in the past, you know?
Yeah. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, it's almost a blessing in disguise that it happened early on in life, because you've got that, I suppose, insight into what it takes to become a good person or become the best version of you early on. Some people learn that later. I think the one important thing from my point of view was that addiction to cricket that I had. I almost felt like I had to find it somewhere else in those years when I stopped playing. And it was only when I began to basically give up on trying to control everything that I was able to move forward, you know, not controlling results, knowing that there was so much that I couldn't do anything about, and that people's decisions or people's view on me is their decision, not mine. And when you begin to realize that, it just gives you this sort of emotional freedom. That, you know, that addiction to something, addiction is usually, you know, is described when I was learning life coaching is a relationship with past trauma that you're trying to suppress. And for me, you know, I suppose in many ways coming out of cricket, addiction to cricket was my escape from some dark times growing up. Now, when I look at it like that, I think, crikey, maybe, although I loved cricket, maybe it was more in depth. It meant more to me. It was something that I had to have in order to escape from something else. So that's where the sort of interesting connection comes from. And you're right, you can get addicted to anything, can't you? People get addicted to the gym and they say, oh, there's nothing wrong with me. Well, you're going to the gym 3 times a day. You know, you literally, that's damaging to your body. So it can literally be anything, but it's sort of recognizing where that addiction has come from. I'm working backwards and unwrapping it that way. And that's really interesting to hear what you've gone through. And I'm happy that you've come out the other side as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Fabian. And, you know, like you said, what you've learned during your life coaching journey, and something that was you know, drilled into us in rehab, whether it's, you know, addiction to any sort of substance or whether it's anger, that's usually a secondary thing. There's always something below that, some sort of, whether it's trauma or an incorrect core belief that you have about yourself or about the world. And it's always that thing under the surface. And if you can address that, it sort of takes care of everything else. And this whole addiction to substances, it's a lot more complex than just a chemical hook. That's just one layer, right? So, and you know, I actually have a quote right here on a post-it note about, you know, what you said about not being able to control what other people think of you and not being able to control what happens. So it's by by Stoic philosopher Epictetus. Don't demand that things happen as you wish, but wish that they happen as they do happen, and you will go on well.
I love it. Oh, I think it's a brilliant quote. I mean, when I look at some of my friends who might use alcohol maybe to suppress something in their life, and that they become reliant on that when they're stressed. Oh, can I have a glass of wine? You know, and they use things that sabotage their emotions so they can escape it without ever having to really face them. I think the self-love journey, when someone's trying to recover from something, happens when you withdraw those self-sabotaging behaviors, because in that position, you have to then face addiction, or you have to face your traumas and you have to deal with it. The thing is, so many people go through the whole of their life suppressing it with substances or, you know, even gym or whatever it might be. I think that's quite a sad thing, because you never realize what your real value is internally and how much you can grow to love yourself and your imperfections without completely taking a step back from those self-sabotaging behaviors.
I know you have to go pretty soon, so why don't you just tell all of us what you're doing nowadays in your life post-cricket with Cal Corner and your life coaching journey and your podcast as well.
Sure. I mean, there's quite a lot going on. I think lockdown definitely opened my eyes to a few things personally, which is where the life coaching came in. I got my level one and level two life coaching qualifications. So I'm working with a number of clients at the moment, which is fantastic. It's eye-opening. It's great to have an impact on people. And the coaching is all about forward thinking. It's all about what can we do in the present to build a better future instead of dwelling over the past. It is using the present moment to make a difference. And that difference to therapy, which is basically uncovering and unwrapping past trauma, we're very much in the moment and move forward. And that really works with everything that I've been through in cricket. And then Cal Corner, we basically transfer vital skills that athletes have into the workspace or use sport as an entertaining tool for people's clients. So around England, India this summer, we're entertaining 100 clients of one of our partners with on the evening of the Lord's Test between England and India, but with David Gower, Graham Gooch, and my father, Chris Cowdery, hosting it. So that'll be a good night for them. And I absolutely love what I'm doing at the moment. Yeah, it can be really challenging having to be an entrepreneur and work all the time towards goals. But as long as I try not to control everything and have that perspective on life and be grateful for what I do have, and that sort of mindset, it allows you to get through each day. And I've taken the pressure off performance every single day, because I know that that's not human, which is the big difference from playing to now.
Just to round things off, Fabian, if people want to find you on social media or wherever, where do they go? How do they find you?
Sure. I suppose the easiest place would be Instagram. I post quite regularly there. I think you'll find if you follow me, and I'm at Fabian K. Cowdery on Instagram. And if you want to talk to me about coaching or anything in particular, drop me a DM or go through my website, and I'd be delighted to support. But thanks so much for having me on, Jay.
Thank you for listening. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All Over Cricket. All Over Cricket features articles and podcasts from contributors spread across the world. We provide fans with original and engaging content. that reflects the truly global and gender-inclusive sport that we believe cricket should be. Please share this episode and tell your friends about All Over Cricket.